The scripture reading today will be from 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 5 through 7. But also for this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love.
In that passage that we just had read for us, paid attention to, I hope, a lot of interesting things occur as we read about the virtues of being a Christian, and they are added one to the other. We might think in many ways about how one comes before the other, how one adds to the other, and that would be an interesting study. But the only point that I want to make from that passage is that it begins with faith and it ends with love. There is an enormous edifice that is built up out of our faith. You have to have faith to begin. And the peak of that, the final culmination of that, is love. And, of course, when we talk about love, we touch on a topic that is near and dear to all of us, one that is popularized and yet one that is much misunderstood. When we talk about love, we mostly think we are concerning ourselves with emotions, powerful emotions. The Bible reminds us, however, that love is as much a matter of behavior as it is a matter of emotions. And that very frequently we think that it is the emotions that lead to the behaviors or the actions, but the truth of the matter is the Bible demonstrates for us, particularly in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, that it is the actions that just as surely lead to the emotions as it is the emotions that can lead to the actions of love. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is known in the world in general as a chapter of the Bible about love. And of course, in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the Apostle Paul is trying to correct the deficiencies that exist in the church at Corinth. And a lot of those deficiencies are a result of the divisions that exist between them. They're not getting along with one another. He demonstrates that even in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 about the difficulties they're having with the Lord's Supper. Some are eating and being filled and making a party of it, and others are doing without. And he says the correction to that is love, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And, of course, that's a very obviously the case and the application we most frequently make of 1 Corinthians chapter 13. But I began last Lord's Day to make an application, 1 Corinthians 13, to the family and the kind of love that exists in the family, the love between husband and wife, love between parents and children, and those kinds of affection, those kinds of love, are as much a matter of enacting and behaving appropriately as the relationship between Christians within a congregation. And so it is that we looked at those, as I see them, 14 different aspects of love or different acts of love that are demonstrated there in those few verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and beginning in verse 4. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 4, I'm reading from the New American Standard, New King James Version. English Standard Version have slightly different translations for these words, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. But 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4, love is patient, love is kind, it is not jealous, love does not brag, and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. And there are maybe different ways to count that. In fact, some of you who are really, really paying attention may note that last week I counted it differently than I did this week. But 14 this week. And as we talked about it last week, we got through the first eight of those, the first seven of those last week. And just very quickly to remind you, when we talk about love is patient or love suffers long, we're talking about the negative aspect of what love doesn't do. Even though love could get its revenge, even though we might be entitled to our revenge because we've been wronged, love refrains from that and does not get its revenge, does not seek some equivalency or some retribution of the other person. It's patient. It's long-suffering. Love puts up with a lot of stuff. And that certainly is the case in family relationships. And the opposite of that, kind of the positive side of that, is that love is kind. Oftentimes we think of kindness as a relatively meek, a relatively mild, a relatively moderate kind of a virtue, but kindness is pretty powerful in the long term. And that's one of the characteristics of love, that it is always kind. And I like particularly the expression that's used in Proverbs 31 and in verse 6, where we talk about the worthy woman, and the law of kindness is on her lips. The law of kindness. It is a law. It is irrevocable. She always says the nice thing. That's the law of kindness. And that characterizes love and ought to characterize our relationship with those that we love, whether it's in a congregation like this, certainly in a marriage relationship, and certainly between parents and children. And three, love does not envy. Love does not envy the good things that come to those that we love. We may be envious of strangers and may wish that we had what they had or that we could change places with them, but when good things happen to the people that we love, we are happy because they are the people we love, and we could never feel envious that they have something good that comes to them. That would certainly be true about husbands and wives. Certainly be true about parents and children. Maybe not always so true between siblings, but it ought to be if we love our brothers and our sisters. We ought to be happy for them when good things come their way. Love does not envy, and love does not parade itself about. Love does not brag. Love is not arrogant. All of those things kind of go together. Love, at least in the relationship with the one that we love, is humble. It never vaunts itself over the other person. It never seeks the ascendancy over the other person. Love is always aware of its unworthiness. When we love someone, we always think better of them than we think of ourselves. Really, that's what the Apostle Paul said in Philippians chapter 2 when he talked about the relationship that ought to exist in the church, that we ought to always seek what's better for others. We ought not to be focused on our own interests, but that clearly ought to be the case in family relationships. And love is not rude. It doesn't interrupt the other person. It doesn't step on the other person's feelings. It's always considerate about the other person. One of the things that we've lost in our society today, I think, is a sense of manners, which is really a matter about courtesy, about giving place to the other person, about making room for them, about treating them with the respect and the dignity that they're due. That would be really helpful in the general marketplace, but it's absolutely necessary at home. But of course, that's where we most forget our manners, is when we are at home. And yet that's where we ought to be most considerate about the other person. Even if it's not so in terms of, you know, the formal manners, it ought to be true in the essence of the way we treat one another in the family. And love does not seek its own, not always looking for what it can get out of the other person. Love, as the Apostle Paul describes about his relationship with the Corinthians, is a desire to spend and to be spent on their behalf. And if we really genuinely loved our husband or a wife, that's what we would do. We would expend ourselves on their behalf, or our children, or our parents, or our brothers and sisters. And love does not get angry. Love is not grouchy. Love is not irritable. It's self-centered people that are grouchy. It's self-centered people that are irritable. It's self-centered people have their feelings hurt and lash out. That's not the way love performs. That's not the way love acts. If we really love the other person, we're concerned about making them happy and not concerned about our own well-being, our own happiness, then we wouldn't be angry with them all the time. So the first eight, that's what we did last time. First eight characteristics of love. So we want to move on now to the new material. Eight, keeps no account of evil. Now one of the things that's kind of interesting about this phrase is there are almost as many different translations of this phrase as there are translations. Because it is so capable of manifold translation, I think that means that it's pretty big, inclusive, and covers a lot of kind of ground here when we say that it keeps no account of evil, or it doesn't hold grudges, or it's not resentful, or it doesn't store up wrongs that are suffered. One of the great arts of loving is forgetting. You know, that old kind of saw from the movie, love means never having to say you're sorry. Well, of course, that was obviously patently wrong from the beginning. But love is really about forgetting. If you love somebody, you forget the things that they have done that have hurt your feelings, that have offended you, the things that are in the past. And we need to be able to forget, to forgive in the same way that God does. You know, the Bible uses enormous expressions to talk about God's love for us, His forgiveness of us. I mean, how it's He puts His sins so far away from us, it's like east and west. It's like they are never recalled again. They're done away with. The slate is wiped clean. Of course, it's not the way we do. You know, we forgive people, but we always keep a little bit of memory of that, just in case they do it again, so we can pull it out and hold it against them again. That's not really forgiving. That's not really forgetting. You know, there are some things that you just have to get over, get past, put it behind you, and it's gone. It's like it could never happen again. Otherwise, the relationship just gets, you know, burdened down more and more and more, sludge in the engine. It's like a weight piled on the wagon that the burro is pulling. You're just not going to get through life if you keep carrying those things around. You have to forgive and forget those things. One of the saddest things to me about David in his whole life, and of course, you know, that includes a life filled with big ups and big downs. I mean, that includes the killing Uriah, which makes me angry every time I think about it. But one of the saddest things about David is when he's on his deathbed and all he can think about and remember is Joab's evil and Shimei's curse. And he says to Solomon, don't you let them get away with that. That's a horrible way to think of ending your life. That's what you think about at the end of your life. You know, and you see some old people and they end their life, you know, on a sense of integrity about what's been in the past and, you know, feel gratitude for the life they lived. And others, they're just kind of worn out and bitter. You don't want your relationships to be that way. You want to be able to forget those things and put them away from you. There are people that just store everything up. And you want to be careful about those people. I always warn the students, you know, don't marry this kind of person. If you find this kind of person, you need to be careful about getting involved with them. We're what we call injustice collectors because they always remember, you know, I don't go in that store because they mistreated me one time. Or those people over there, you know, they'll cheat you every time. Everywhere they go, people are mistreating them. Everything they do, somebody is taking advantage of them. You think that's not going to hold true when you're married to them? That's going to be true about them because that's who they are. They're injustice collectors. That's what they do is go through life trying to find things to be upset about. But that's not the way love is. Love keeps no account of wrong suffered. And nine, love doesn't rejoice in iniquity either. Love doesn't like to hear about the misfortunes of other people. It's glad when the truth prevails. It's glad when truth, justice, can I say the American way? To this group, maybe. Prevails. That's a good thing. And we rejoice in that. And we're upset when those things are not prevailing. But there's a sense in which some people are glad when they hear bad things about others, when they hear that people have fallen into some kind of misfortune or fallen into some kind of temptation. The Germans had a word for that, that it became popular for a while in the United States, Schadenfreude. That is, you're a little bit happy when you hear people have done bad things, because it's like, it's not me. I didn't do that. They did that. But that's not the way love is. Love does not rejoice in bad things. Love, instead, rejoices in the good things, especially for those that we love. Surely, when our spouse does something that's not quite right, we're not happy about that. When something bad happens to them, we're not happy about that. We rejoice, however, when good things occur to them. When our children are insulted, we're insulted. When they are praised, we feel good. There's nothing that is quite so gratifying to love as seeing the person that you love experience something good. That's what love really is all about. And that's one of the things that we say when we get to the, to the marriage ceremony, that these two people, by sharing their good things and their bad things, can make the bad things less bad and the good things better. They can share those things together. Love rejoices in the good things, and it suffers with the bad. We cry with those who cry, and we rejoice with those who rejoice. And 11, love bears all things and endures all things. You know, one of the things that is amazing about love is what it can put up with. And not in the sense that we'll go back to the first thing, that is that love is patient, but that it just keeps going. It just is not exhausted. That love endures any insult, it endures any transgression, any fault, any misunderstanding. Love cannot be turned aside, not even by the worst kind of behavior. You know, it's kind of a issue I've seen in families occasionally, and the child does this terrible thing, or they've demonstrated this terrible kind of penchant for evil, and the parents disown them. And there are some things that ought to be condemned. There's no doubt that sin, transgressions ought to be condemned. But disowning your own children, I mean, you just cannot be turned aside if you love them. You can't get rid of them. They are yours. Same thing ought to be true about husbands and wives. You know, it doesn't matter what they do. You love them, and you're just going to persist with them. It doesn't matter. Love is not turned aside by trivial things. You look at God's example of love and the way he loved Israel, his chosen people, through all of their difficulties, through all of the disturbances of their idolatry and their ingratitude. And yet he always came back for them, because love is not turned aside. Maybe the most graphic illustration of that, both of God's love for Israel and the kind of love that a man has for a wife, or a wife has for a husband, or children for their parents and parents for their children, is in Hosea. I mean, you go back and read Hosea again, and it's like, I don't even want to read that book because of how hard it is for Hosea when his wife does terrible, terrible things. And yet, there's a message of kind of encouragement there, because he goes and buys her back again. Because he loves her, because she's his wife, he is not going to be deterred by that. And that's the message that God's delivering to Israel. Doesn't matter. I have chosen you, and I love you, and I will redeem you for my own. And that's the way it ought to be, husbands and wives, and parents and children, that love can bear all things and endure all things. Love always finds a way to do what is good for the one that we love. There's always something that you can do. And it's powerful, isn't it? That kind of love is powerful in the way in which it can change another person. You know, the parable of that, I think, is to think of mother's love for children. And wherever they go and whatever they do, they know their mother loves them. And if nobody else does, their mother loves them. And that somehow pulls them back from the brink of self-destruction, maybe. And that goes along with 12, believes all things. Love believes all things. And now that goes back to that passage, 2 Peter, and to your faith add virtue, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the last of these is love. I mean, love is the peak of the monument that's built on trust. We think about faith a lot, and, you know, because of the kind of emotional approach to Scripture that denominationalists have used, we've emphasized over the years, and rightly so, that faith comes from hearing and hearing from the Word of God. And very frequently then we get to the idea that faith is just really kind of equivalent to knowledge. We just know stuff, maybe by a different kind of sense than the eyes and the ears and the taste and the touch. But faith is much more than that. When we talk about faith, and when Peter talks about adding to your faith virtue, we're talking about trust. We're talking about, because of the evidence that we have, our trust in God, our confidence that He will do what is right. And that's what love really is all about, too, in family relationships, is we have trust in the other person. We trust the other person to do the right kind of thing. And that builds up into this sense of love for the other person. Because love is built on trust. Marriage is not possible where there's no trust. And where trust fails, then love fails too. I mean, it becomes hopeless if you don't trust the other person. And so we always, always believe the other person. We always believe in the good of the other person. Even when they have failed. Even when they have fallen short of our expectations. Even when it looks like they've deliberately done the wrong kind of thing. We still believe. And it's not, you know, that we just disregard the information, but we believe in the goodness of the person. We believe in the inward capacity of that person for being transformed, for doing better things in the future. Love is not suspicious of the other person. I mean, we always impute the best motives to what the other person does. You know, sometimes more prosaically, we talk about, walk a mile in a man's shoes before you condemn him. To put yourself in the other person's place, what would I have done in that place if I had been subjected to those kinds of burdens and those kinds of difficulties? But then, of course, you know, we don't ever know what the other person's position is. We don't ever know what they really are experiencing. But it's true that love is always going to think the best of the other person. Thomas Carlyle, writing about this passage 150 years ago, wrote this interesting paragraph. Granted, he wrote, the ship comes into the harbor with shrouds and tackle damaged. The pilot is blameworthy. He has not been all wise and all powerful. But to know how blameworthy, tell us first, whether his voyage has been around the globe or only to Ramsgate and the Isle of the Dogs, which is just kind of a short trip around the harbor there. You don't know what the other person's experienced. You don't know what kind of pressures they've been subjected to. You know the result. You know it's not what you would have wanted, but you don't know how hard they tried to do the right thing in those circumstances. You just can't know that. But if you love them, you're not suspicious. If you love them, you put the best emphasis on that. If you love them, you give them the benefit of the doubt. Love believes all things. If the person you love says, this is the way it is, then that's what you believe, because that's what they said. And they are the person that you love, and you trust that person. It's a shame to take advantage of that and tell somebody that trusts you that much a lie. You know, it's almost like you can't do it. You know, you can lie to those people because they're suspicious and they're always looking out for themselves. So, you know, misguiding them is okay. But even the most profligate person feels a little bit kind of reprehensible when they lie to somebody that's going to believe whatever they say. You know, the school kids, you know, they love putting it over on the shrewd, the suspicious, the cynical teachers. That even they feel a little bad about taking advantage of some poor, innocent teacher that just believes everything you say anyway. Love believes everything. And that's powerful. And that's really important, I think, not only between husbands and wives, important between parents and children, that you have to believe them. We think about the sense that, you know, responsibility encourages the building of trust. But trust encourages people to take responsibility too. You know, if they know you're not going to believe them anyway, then why do they have to worry about it? If they know you don't think they're going to be able to get it done anyway, then why should they try to do it right? Love believes all things. It believes in the goodness of the other person. Because that's what love really is about. And when we want somebody that loves us, that's what we expect, is that they have that kind of confidence in us. And we owe them that too. Love not only believes all things, love hopes all things. Love just cannot be discouraged. Love knows that the other person is capable of goodness. Love knows that the other person is really inwardly gentle and sweet and kind and trying to get out and to do that in life. Love believes in the future of the person that we love. We hope for better in the future for them. Love's willing to work for that transformation, but it believes in the power of that transformation. You know, in some ways, one of the things that we say in marriage vows, till death do us part, is really kind of a vow that says, I'll never give up on you. You know, and that's easy, of course, to say, you know, in the prime of youth when everything seems to be okay and everybody is, you know, bright with promise and, you know, shiny with hope. But, you know, that's what love is all about. I'm never going to give up on you. Doesn't matter what the consequences are, doesn't matter what the circumstances are, doesn't matter what changes outside of this relationship, I am never, ever going to give up on you. That's what family security is built on. That's the devastation of easy no-fault divorce laws. Because people are saying, "Nah, it's not really for keeps, it's not really that kind of security. As long as you are what I think you ought to be, as long as you're what I wanted you to be, and I could even change my mind about that, but as long as that's suitable, you know, we'll stay together. But if things ever change, I always got an out." You know, one of the most devastating things we've done to marriage is to provide easy divorce. That ought not to be the case. People ought to live by the vow. I'm never going to give up on you, because we want that. We want people to be that kind of persistent in our well-being. And that's what we owe to them as well. And our children, too. You never give up on them. You know, this just doesn't happen. Someone once defined home as where when you go, they have to take you in. Because they don't give up on you. You know, they may throw you out of school. And they may throw you out of work, and they may get tired of you at the congregation, but your family doesn't give up on you. Love believes all things and hopes all things, and love never fails. It just doesn't fail. It's there as a part of what we can count on in life. There aren't many things that are guaranteed in this life. And, you know, we live in a world that more and more aware of is kind of on shaky ground. you know, finances, the economy. We're not as hopeful about that as we once were in America. And maybe we never should have been hopeful about that, not put our confidence in that. Not even so confident anymore in the world right now the way it is today about the future and world affairs and, you know, what America is going to be going forward. But we need something to stand on. We need something to count on. And that's why it's so important to have family. That's why it's so important for people to find that kind of pair bond in which here's somebody I can count on. Doesn't matter what happens to the economy, doesn't matter what happens to the country, doesn't matter what happens internationally, doesn't matter. Here's a person that I can count on. Here's someone that won't fail me. It's what pop culture says. I always hate this expression. I'll be there for you. People say, I'll be there for you. You can count on me. But there is some wisdom in that, because that's what we need. Can you count on them? Who are the people that you can count on? Who are the people that are going to be there for you? Those people that love you will be there for you. They won't fail you. Of course, the other side of that's also got to be true, that if we love other people, we're going to be there for them. We're not going to fail them. And of course, you know, that's easy to say when we're not facing any kind of difficulties, when everything is just the way we want it, just so-so, and we're not irritated, and everything looks rosy, I'll be there for you. But that's not what love is. Love is going to be there, even when those circumstances change, and even when they're not so favorable. Love is never going to fail. It's the strongest power of the soul. It is sustaining power, not only for the other person, but for us as well. You know, and it really makes a difference in our lives when we know that there are people who are going to believe in us, people who are going to hope for us no matter what, people who are never going to fail us. That's powerful. That sustains us and moves us forward. Apostle Paul, of course, is talking about congregational relationships. All of these things are true about that as well. But we've made the application to this in terms of family, of love, of the kind of relationship that we have in our families. And I think we see that really as a place that we count on this kind of sustaining love, even if everything else fails in life. You know, it's a disgrace and a sad thing to see that in our society today, they're trying to redefine all of that, trying to change what the nature of the family is, to change marriage from being, you know, this kind of all-out, total, complete, lifelong commitment that sustains us, to being just kind of a temporary emotional attachment that can occur between any kind of people at any kind of time for any length of time. And, you know, it's just not really any much different than just passing friendships or passing fads. That'll be a sad day when society in general loses that. But we ought not to lose that. We ought to lose that in our own families, and we ought not to lose that in the church, because that's the way God intended it. He made us because we need those kind of relationships, and He made the relationships to satisfy those kind of needs. But of course, this is a spiritual setting. And we need to recognize that in this spiritual setting, that really the kind of love that's most important and the kind of love that sets the precedence for the love that we experience in our marriages and in our families is the love that God has for us. You know, and it's become almost trite. For years, they would hold up John 3:16 in the end zone of the football games. Maybe we'll look back at that period of time, naive as it was, and wish for its return. But you really ought to impress on your heart and not see as just trivial those words. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. You know, you could think about all of these things in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, particularly these last. in relationship to God's love for us. God never fails. He never gives up on us. In the history of mankind, you can see that with his relationship with Israel. You can see that in his relationship to us. He has done everything possible to reconcile us to himself. Not because we were worthy. Not because we'd done anything to deserve it. Not because anybody else objectively would say there's hope for that person. But because he loved us. He sent his only begotten Son to die on the cross, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. And of course, you know, we might just take a moment to acknowledge whoever believes in him is not just a matter of, you know, a passing nod of the head. As Jesus says, you believe in me, you obey my commandments, and all of that incorporates. But that's trivial compared to the fact that God sent Jesus to die on the cross when we were sinners and unworthy and undeserving, when we were unlovely, corrupted and corroded by sin. God loved us enough to send Jesus to die on the cross for us. We owe that to our families. But isn't it great to know that we get that from God in heaven through Jesus? He has prepared a place for us that we might come and be with him. He will forgive us of every sin, wash us clean, forget them and put them away, and reconcile us to himself if we are willing to confess him before men, to be baptized for the remission of our sins. And if we are willing, every single time we fall short, to acknowledge those sins before him, confess in as public a manner as we have committed those sins, and return to him, he will take us back because he loves us enough to send his Son to die for us. If you're here this morning and your relationship with Jesus Christ is not what it ought to be, if your relationship to God has been severed by sin, then you need to be reconciled. Jesus is here inviting you to come, even as we stand and sing this song to encourage you.